I suspect the center of gravity, as Ukraine looks at Russia at the moment, is the extent to which Putin's army genuinely has confidence in Putin. And if that confidence begins to creak a bit, then that may have an impact upon the battlefield. And I suspect that's Ukraine's best hope at the moment, is that that political vulnerability begins to worry his army.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. Vladimir Putin once cited Winston Churchill when he said Russia was never so strong as it wants to be and never so weak as is thought to be. 10 days after the rebellion by the Wagner Group threatening a coup, and 17 months after the invasion, we're extremely fortunate and very appreciative to welcome back General Sonic Carter, former Chief of Defence Staff, and a man who was very early in articulating the threats posed by Putin's Russia. And here we are sitting in London. Kiev is only 1,400 miles away, and it's somewhat surreal, as we're in the middle of Wimbledon and the cricket season, that this war is raging, and yet we carry on our lives. So, Nick, welcome back. You are our only guest to have made a third appearance.
No, Simon, thanks. It's a great privilege to be with you again.
Let's just dive in. From a military perspective, what is the situation report?
I think that means focusing right down onto the battlefield. And the answer is, I think we have to be very careful not to be too optimistic about what's playing out on that battlefield. And we all know that the first casualty of war is always the truth. And of course, both sides will be very clear about their propaganda at this point in time. And of course, there's been a lot of expectation riding on the Ukraine army on the back of being given a whole load of Western bits of kit, tanks and armored infantry fighting vehicles and artillery systems. So there is this expectation that something amazing might occur, not least because, of course, they did something amazing back in September of last year when they did a long maneuver around the northern city of Kharkiv and took back a significant amount of countryside. But what has changed this time, I'm afraid, is that the Russians have put in place a very effective general. He's now been dismissed, in fact, General Surovikin, who knows what he's doing, and he has created a formidable line of defences. And this includes minefields, anti-tank ditches, dragon's teeth, those large concrete blocks that impede the movement of tanks, and of course, dug-in infantry positions supported by artillery and tanks. So it's defence in depth, and that's a very, very challenging battlefield for anybody to prevail upon. And when you add to that the fact that obstacle crossing and offensive operations are fundamentally difficult, we're asking a lot of the Ukrainian army to be able to achieve this. And I think what we're seeing is, rather than some great decisive maneuver, we're seeing probably the development of three attacks in three different sectors. And I think what they're trying to see is what that means to the way Russia moves its reserves around and where perhaps they're most likely to find weak points and where then perhaps they can develop a more significant axis of advance. And I don't think we'll see that play out quickly. I think we're going to see a lot of bloodshed, a lot of tactical activity, but I very much doubt we'll see anything decisive anytime soon. I'm afraid I'm pessimistic, perhaps. I think that asking them to do this is challenging. And I think that when I cast back to my early military career, trying to become accustomed to using these armored vehicles in a sophisticated way, given the sort of challenge that Ukraine has got, it took us years to be able to become proficient. And we were a regular battalion of infantry with professional soldiers in it. So it's going to be difficult. It's going to be bloody. And I'm not necessarily optimistic as to how that fight will evolve.
And how does that translate into political perspective on both sides of the divide?
Well, of course, I think what's really critical for Ukraine is that they need to demonstrate to their Western supporters that they've got a chance of succeeding. Now, how you define success, defeat, victory, these are terms that different people will have different labels attaching to them. But they've got to show some sort of success. So politically, this is very important for President Zelensky. He needs to demonstrate that the equipment he's received and the training that his army has received is leading towards something that looks successful. So it's a difficult political position from his perspective. Now, of course, his big hope, and I think we saw that playing out, and your introductory remarks touched on Mr. Prigozhin. The reality is, of the events of 10 days ago, that the weekend before last, when Prigozhin conducted a mutiny with his Wagner Group, his private military and security company, and that will have an impact on Russian politics, not immediately. I don't think coup attempts in Russia necessarily lead anywhere quickly ever, and history proves that. But I do think it will have an impact upon the way in which Putin's army and Putin's supporters perceive Putin's strength, because he did not look like a strong leader that weekend. When he came on to the media in order to be able to explain what was happening, he looked like he'd had to think about it too quickly. He didn't look confident. He didn't look as assured as he does usually. So I think this is probably the beginning of the end, but I don't think the end will happen particularly quickly. Now, that said, who knows? It's a fragile kleptocracy that he sits over the top of. And those sorts of regimes are vulnerable. They always will be vulnerable. It's a question of where that vulnerability is exploited. And I suspect there'll be other strong men sitting around him now who will be wondering about his longevity. And that, of course, is a difficult position for him to be in. And I suspect that ultimately, and we military like to talk about centers of gravity, because those are the areas both of strength and of weakness that you might want to apply military and greater strengths to. I suspect the center of gravity, as Ukraine looks at Russia at the moment, is the extent to which Putin's army genuinely has confidence in Putin. And if that confidence begins to creak a bit, then that may have an impact upon the battlefield. And I suspect that's Ukraine's best hope at the moment, is that that political vulnerability begins to worry his army, and his army's therefore ability to fight becomes diminished. That's his best chance, I'd have thought.
So just pausing on this Wagner group, I mean, for those of us who are not familiar with the makeup of the Russian army, we hear about the Wagner group, and then I gather there are a number of other of these private armies. And I guess that what struck me was that they, in a short space of time, downed 6 Russian helicopters and a specified control plane. And then Putin has to get away with telling their kin that Prigozhin has been pardoned. I mean, are you astounded, or are you actually... You're the world-weary observer of this. Nothing surprises you about Russia.
No, I mean, I think it goes back to how Putin governs his country. I mean, I think he absolutely doesn't believe in power being centralized. He believes in diverse centers of power, so he can play one end off against the middle. And of course, what's been playing out, I think, over the last 6 months in terms of Prigozhin is the extent to which he has been having a go at Defense Minister Shoigu and Chief of the General Staff Valery Gerasimov. And he's been criticizing their conduct of the war. And in particular, he's been criticizing the extent to which they have given equipment and resources to Prigozhin's Wagner Group. Now, the Wagner Group, probably on the ground in Ukraine, had some 25,000 fighters. And to be honest, they were probably the only fighters on that battlefield on the Russian side who were capable of conducting offensive operations. And that's why we've had this long-running battle in the city of Bakhmut. And that battle really has been won on behalf of Russia by Prigozhin and his Wagner group. The Russian army haven't been able to take part in offensive operations, given their weakness and their lack of moral component and morale more generally. So I think what we've seen playing out is this long-term criticism by Prigozhin of Shoigu and Gerasimov and the general staff in the Russian military more generally. And I think that what he was wanting to see happen on the back of his mutiny was Shoigu and Gerasimov being removed. Now, I'm told we haven't seen much of Shoigu or Gerasimov in the public space over the last 10 days. Maybe something has happened. The fact that Suravikin, who I mentioned earlier, who was closely associated and supportive, I think, of some of what Prigozhin was doing on the battlefield, has now been dismissed, would also indicate that Putin is trying to stamp down on the way in which Prigozhin has spread his effect more broadly into the security structure as a whole. So divide and rule, I think, is the way that Putin tends to run these things. And that's what I think we've seen playing out with the Wagner Group. Now, what will be interesting is to see how the Wagner Group plays out in its broader efforts globally, because the Wagner Group is very much a feature of what we see happening in Africa at the moment. A number of African governments have turned to the Wagner Group because the Wagner Group provides them with security, advice, capacity building. And of course, from the Wagner's group perspective, it gives them resources because they're able to steal stuff from African mines, gold, precious metals, and make sure that Russia are getting those rather than the West. It's an arrangement of convenience. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out over the course of the next few months and whether Wagner still continues to be run in that fashion or whether it's nationalized. And the last thing I'd say about it is what is also fascinating is to see Putin 8 or 9 days ago admitting that they were paying the Wagner Group from the Russian state. That's the first time we've ever had a public admission that the Wagner Group is anything to do with the Russian state. Because up until now, over the last 5 to 10 years, the Wagner Group has always been deniable. It's always been a way of Putin prosecuting his foreign security policy objectives abroad without frankly ever admitting that the Wagner Group has been at the heart of that happening.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches.
So, if you were a chess player, what would be the moves you'd like to see made by the West?
I think I might challenge the analogy slightly, because I think that probably what is needed is a strategy. And whilst I think chess is a game where, broadly speaking, you might have a general strategy, I think on the whole, you tend to think one, two, three, four, and if you're very good, maybe five or six moves ahead. Here, I'm not sure I see that happening. I think that what has, for understandable reasons, driven Western strategy, and particularly the US administration strategy over the last 16 months, has been an absolute fundamental requirement to avoid escalation, to contain this war within the borders of Ukraine, if possible. And of course, that's difficult. Once you've made that to be your overriding constraint, it becomes very difficult, therefore, to declare an end state, to determine what defeat and victory look like, and then to go all out to achieve the objective of victory. And that's why what we've seen, I think, over the course of the last 16 months is a process of incremental reinforcement, where we've, in a sense, been dragged kicking and screaming by President Zelensky's very sophisticated political maneuvering, increasingly to give Ukraine additional capability, equipment, and training. My own personal view is if we want Ukraine to get into a position where we can lead to a conversation about how this war ends, is we've got to double down and help them even more. They need to find a way of restoring at least the status quo ante 24 February last year. And that, to my mind, is critical, because otherwise this is not going to lead to a conclusive outcome. And I think if we don't have a conclusive outcome, and I'm sure we'll carry on talking about this in a moment later in our conversation, that could just make matters worse.
The observation that you made in our first conversation was all wars end in a conversation. And I was chatting to our mutual friend, Colonel, as he was then, Johnny Gray, who served, you know, under you in Iraq. And he said, is a negotiated settlement the only way this ends?
I personally think that a lot will depend upon how Ukraine's offensive goes during the course of this summer, and where we end up as winter hits Ukraine in October or November this year. I then think a lot depends upon whether Western support remains sustained, consistent, and positive behind Ukraine's efforts. Now, if, as I fear may happen, Ukraine are not able to push the lines on the battlefield much further east than where they are at the moment, then I fear that you may find that Western support becomes a little less firm, and you may find that there are clarion calls for the beginning of some form of conversation. And I fear that where that might end would be in some form of armistice, like perhaps we've seen on the Korean Peninsula since the 1950s, which means the war, in a sense, goes into a state of formal freesia, where both sides agree that they are not going to fight each other, but of course the war is not yet over. And I fear that's a very possible outcome. It is definitely a scenario that I think people to reflect upon, because that wouldn't be conclusive. What, of course, it might mean is that Russia perhaps would have the opportunity to reconstitute, perhaps go back on the front foot in 2, 3, 4 years' time. Who knows, depending upon what happens to Mr. Putin. So I think that's a very possible outcome. If, on the other hand, Western support doubles down and gives Ukraine the chance of achieving a bit more, and one gets into a position where Ukraine might feel that it's worth negotiating towards a settlement, that would be a different position to be in. But I think that's, regrettably, as things stand at the moment, a less likely scenario, because I fear that Western patience won't be sustained over a longer period of time that it would take to get to that sort of position. We shall see, but I don't see at the moment the likelihood of a conclusive outcome during the course of this calendar year.
And if we move forward 3 years, given that uncertainty, we've got NATO, we've got EU, we've got Ukraine aspirations and Western accommodation, how might one envisage those relationships working with Ukraine?
Well, I think that as a minimum, NATO and the West has got to give Ukraine a security guarantee. Whether that means membership of NATO or not is another matter, but it certainly must be a security guarantee, because without that, I think Ukraine would have fought for nought. I also think the European Union is a potential boon in all of this from Ukraine's perspective. But ultimately, I think that you're going to end up in a position where I don't think we will be able to trust Russia for many years to come. A lot, of course, depends upon how Russian politics evolve. But let's work on the assumption that Mr. Putin hangs around, or if he doesn't, he's replaced by somebody who shares certainly similar views, if not slightly more extreme views. Then I think you're going to see NATO countries being obliged to deploy forces forward on Russia's borders to provide adequate deterrence. And I think that is going to require Western countries to spend more on defence than they spend at the moment. And that's something that I think will test people. But ultimately, that's the likely outcome, I think, if this war is not conclusive in its ending and determination.
So I mentioned on our earlier conversation, there's this terrific book, Putin's People by Catherine Belton, which I read, and with growing astonishment at how this St. Petersburg mafia, which Putin was the epicenter, is what we would all understand to be organized crime, but so well entrenched that it seems, you know, almost difficult to imagine a different regime. You talked earlier on about morale of the men in the field. Is there a moderate somewhere in the Russian political structure who could emerge, or is that wishful thinking?
I'm no expert on the intimacy of Russian politics around Putin, but my sense of what I've read is that that's unlikely. I think what's probably more likely is somebody who's perhaps even more patriotic, inverted commas, than Putin would emerge. But that said, there are the stuff being written this week, isn't there, which is suggesting, I think, that some of the people around Putin are running out of patience on this war and the way it's conducted. And of course, the great advantage to a successor is they can claim this is Putin's war, and actually they can step away from it, and perhaps they can get to a position where they can stop the war. And that, I think, would be a possible outcome, and of course would be a great advantage, however ultra-patriotic that particular person might be. So I think the sense that it is Putin's war is a very important point, because others could say that they could treat this in a very different way.
We're lucky enough to have you here today. Don't want to let you leave without a couple of other geopolitical blocks that are supremely important. In our earlier interview, you described China as a chronic challenge. And dealing with China, as we know, is occupying lots of press. And the sense is that the acrimony has increased. But of course, we're consuming papers and we're not there behind closed doors. What's your sense of the positioning between the US, essentially, and China?
Is the absolutely key relationship with all of this. And I think we should be encouraged by the fact that Secretary of State Blinken went to Beijing a week or so ago. And of course, what he's trying to establish and fundamentally is needed in this relationship are some guardrails in which the relationship can be managed. Because of course, what we're seeing play out in the Indo-Pacific is a significant arms race. And arms races are dangerous if they're not controlled. Because if you don't have guardrails, then there is always the risk of miscalculation. And that arms race is not just in China, who are expanding their navy and the PLA very quickly, and a lot of their nuclear arsenal as well. It's an arms race that's playing out in Japan, on the Korean Peninsula, in Australia, and of course also in countries like the Philippines, where the US have now established, or are establishing, 4 new bases this year. Now, all of that is dangerous. And when you see exercising occurring around Taiwan, that exercising, if it's not properly controlled, could very easily lead to some form of accident or miscalculation. And that's the bit we have to watch. And of course, if you go back to the days of the Cold War, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, a hotline was created and confidence building measures were put in place between the Soviet bloc and NATO and the United States, more importantly. And we used to have arms control and arms control inspection regimes and everything associated with it. None of that prevails in the Indo-Pacific, where World War II did not end as conclusively as it did in Europe. So the Americans are absolutely right to try and help the Chinese get to a position where we establish these guardrails. And my own view is there's a lot more going on behind the scenes than we might imagine, and that both governments recognize that they're going to have to collaborate and cooperate, and they need to establish some confidence-building measures that enable them to be able to evolve and grow together in a productive and constructive fashion.
The other theater where change is happening much quicker than many of us could ever envisage is the Middle East. I know you've just come back from Israel, and we having an exchange earlier on about the movements on that chessboard. Just give us a sense of what are the outcomes that you are thinking are going to define that troubled landscape?
Well, I think there are some themes that are changing, particularly the Gulf, but the Middle East more broadly. I think the first obvious theme is that US influence and interest is waning. I mean, now the US is energy independent. Indeed, I was reading this morning, is actually an energy exporter, not least oddly to China. The fact of the matter is that the US has less interest in it. And of course, ever since the invasion of Iraq and since the awakening, US influence has also declined. The US's reliability as a security partner is also being questioned slightly. You'll recall the Iranian attack on the Aramco facility in 2019 in Saudi Arabia. The US response was negligible, and that begged questions from Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, the withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, again, begged a lot of questions about the reliability of the US as an ally. So I think US interest and influence is waning, and I think it's being backfilled by other great powers, not least China, who've got significant energy and economic interests in the Gulf and the Middle East more broadly. So I think that's an interesting theme. I then think there's a significant theme of the requirement of these very rich states to diversify economically. And they're doing that because, of course, they've got significant youth unemployment, and they need to offer education opportunity in order for their populations to be happy. And whilst the next 5 to 10 years are likely to be profitable from a fossil fuel perspective, if you're Saudi Arabia or Qatar or even the Emirates, the reality is that that is on the decline. I guess from 2030 onwards, people are now thinking about the need to be in a different place economically than just supplying those sorts of energy requirements. So if you want to have economic diversification, you also need stability. And I think that's the third obvious theme we're seeing in the Middle East and the Gulf at the moment. We've seen the Abraham Accords, which is the agreement between Israel and Arab states, particularly Bahrain, the Emirates and Morocco, and maybe Saudi Arabia will become a signatory of the Accords as well in the next year or two. That's very good economically, but it's also good in terms of stability. We're seeing Syria readmitted to the Arab League this year. And of course, we've seen that rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran brokered by China, allegedly. And that is a very interesting move. And I think it shows a much more assertive foreign policy, particularly from Mohammed bin Salman's Saudi Arabia. And I think what you're also seeing on the back of this detente is you're seeing more assertive foreign policy from these countries. And I think increasingly Saudi Arabia is claiming to lead much of the Arab world, which is not a position one would have been in 30 years ago when it was obvious that Egypt or even Iraq were the leaders of the Arab world. So I think there's some very interesting things happening. And when you put on top of all of that, the fear that perhaps Iran is getting very close to a nuclear weapon and maybe only a couple of weeks away from breakout to achieve a nuclear weapon. And when you consider that Israel is wrestling with challenging domestic politics and has got a much more right-wing government than we've ever seen before, how those two factors play into this and whether Israel would be content to see Iran get that close to a bomb, there are lots of wild cards that can play into this. Not least, what's another term of President Erdogan going to look like in the Eastern Mediterranean? He definitely has foreign policy ambitions that perhaps chime a little with where the Ottoman Empire once was.
Yes, well, we'd be remiss not to comment on one investment implication, which is with 85% of the world's energy being supplied by fossil fuels and, you know, clarion calls for all the green emerging technologies to replace it, that the lack of perhaps realism, but the underinvestment by the oil majors has, I would certainly observe, created the possibility for significantly higher energy prices when we get through this slowdown. And so the investment implications of all of what you're talking about are going to be profound. We're lucky enough that in a couple of weeks' time, I'm giving up my chair for July to Jen Prosek, a previous guest. She's going to interview Mike Pompeo, which could be great fun. Would you have a question for Mr. Pompeo?
Yes, I'd like to understand what he thinks the US should be doing in foreign security policy terms these days, particularly in relation to China, but also in relation to the impact of China globally.
Okay, we will put that on the agenda. So, Nick, thank you for coming this Monday morning and breaking your day to give us this update. It's really terrific for all of us. And I think our listeners, we are now in 110 countries and reaching, I think, near close to a million people a year now through audio and video. So there will be a lot of people who listen to you. And it was very interesting when we interviewed your friend, General Petraeus, suddenly on the map of where our listeners were, two popped up in Iran. So there you go. The power of the podcast. Anyway, Nick, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for being here today.
No, thanks, Simon. It's been fun as ever.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, chief executive of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine, and as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold, and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business, and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by LiveTrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. Live Trade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, BordeauxIndex.com/LiveTrade. In addition, I'd like to quickly share a few details about GAIN, who we're highlighting and supporting as our 2023 third quarter partner. GAIN, which stands for Girls Are Investors, is a leading charity dedicated to improving gender diversity in the investment management industry. GAIN currently has a team of over 1,000 volunteers dedicated to helping young women understand the industry and their potential careers in it. They're always open to welcoming new volunteers or sponsors who are looking to support their mission. If this is something yourself or any of your colleagues might be interested in, please visit gainuk.org to learn more, or just tap the link in the episode description right here in your preferred podcast app.